This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. We look into problem drinking in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. How do people with a drinking problem stop? Total abstinence and Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the answer that likely springs to mind. But according to our guest this afternoon, there's more than one path to sobriety. Health and medical journalist Ann Fletcher reports that there are many ways to get and stay sober. Fletcher, who faced her own battle with alcohol, surveyed hundreds of people, men and women, who have resolved a drinking problem. Some got sober with AA. Others did it on their own. Some used sobriety programs other than AA. Most gave up drinking completely, but a small number gave up the heavy drinking for an occasional drink. Ann Fletcher tells the stories of the more than 200 people she surveyed in Sober for Good, New Solutions for Drinking Problems, Advice from Those Who Have Succeeded. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Ann Fletcher. Join us with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Ann Fletcher is a former executive editor of the Tufts University Health and Nutrition Letter. She is also the author of the books Thin for Life and Eating Thin for Life. Her new book, Sober for Good, is published by Houghton Mifflin. Listeners, again, those telephone numbers, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Ann Fletcher, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Good morning, Celeste. Thanks for the nice introduction. That was a beautiful recap of what the book is all about.
It's a very nice book. Very good book. I think it's a very important book.
Thank you.
To begin, tell us about your experience.
Well, I was a person who struggled with drinking on and off for a good 10 years of my life and basically decided that it just wasn't worth it anymore to struggle to try to drink moderately. I didn't like what it did to me. I was a high-functioning problem drinker. I did all the things that I do now when I was drinking. I still jogged 5 miles a number of times a week. I ate healthfully. I had a decent marriage. I was what's called a high-functioning problem drinker, but I wasn't functioning optimally in my life. I found that alcohol made me depressed. I wasn't as productive. It made me not sleep as well. It made me forgetful. And after years of working, I resolved my alcohol problem mainly through one-on-one therapy with counselors, psychologists who had expertise with alcohol problems, who didn't insist that I do it just one way. They let me find my own way, largely using moderation approaches with varying degrees of success for many years before I decided to give it up completely.
Mm. And what have you gained by giving it up?
Oh, I just feel like all the things that I said that it took away from me were given back to me. I sleep better. I have more energy. I'm more productive. And I don't struggle with depression anymore. So I feel and like the people in Sober for Good. I feel like I've been given so many things back. And one of the things that struck me as I was surveying each of these 222 people in the book was sent a 7-page questionnaire about their drinking history, the turning point, and how they finally found a solution that was right for them, and then how they've gotten on with their lives. And one of the things that struck me was how incredibly happy these people are. There doesn't seem to be anything missing once they take alcohol away. It's hard in the beginning. I don't mean to suggest this is easy. But basically, you had to have had at least 5 years of sobriety to be in the book. The average length of sobriety for the group of 222 people is 13 years. And basically, a lot of these people are happier. They seem to almost celebrate sobriety and be happier than a lot of people I know who never had drinking problems in the first place.
Mm. You refer to the people you surveyed and interviewed as masters.
Yes, masters of their alcohol problem.
Okay. Is that your word? I mean,
yep.
we think of alcoholics, we think of recovering alcoholics, we think of recovered alcoholics and the like, but you chose the word masters.
Right, because I feel that people have mastered their alcohol problems. There are different ways of seeing this, but basically I see it as a more empowering word. There are people who have gotten on top of their alcohol problems is the way I described it. When I was recruiting people for the book, my words were, have you resolved a serious drinking problem for 5 or more years? And then when I was explaining to people what it was that I meant by that, I said that basically I feel that it's somebody who's been on top of a drinking problem, not, you know, the other way around for at least 5 years.
How would you advise someone with a problem to use your book?
Well, I would say use it as a resource. I think, you know, we're getting to be smart consumers when we shop for medical care these days, and I think it's so important for people to shop around if they're struggling with an alcohol problem. I guess I should back up and say first I would use the book as a guidebook to, because usually people struggle for a long time trying to figure out, do I have a problem? Is this really a problem? Am I an alcoholic? And I think one of the most important messages of the book is that you don't have to call yourself an alcoholic. There's no research evidence that confessing you're an alcoholic is necessary in order to overcome a drinking problem. And I think that that makes a lot of people feel relieved because they don't want the label. There's so much of a stigma attached to that still in our society. So, you know, I think that the book offers some important wake-up call questions, warning signs that people shared with me that they had a problem. They didn't all hit bottom. That's a myth. There's so many myths that these people shatter about alcohol recovery. I would like to reach out to people before they hit bottom, and I purposely share stories not only of people who were made destitute by their drinking, but people who were, like me, high-functioning problem drinkers who did something about an alcohol problem before it got really bad. And then to use the book as a guide to, if you feel that you do have a problem, the book has so many resources in it and tells the stories of how people found approaches that were right for them. Use it as a consumer guide to shop around and find an approach that's right for you.
At the outset of the book, you emphasize that the book is not meant to take the place of professional guidance in dealing with an alcohol problem. Yet you also say one can quit on her own, and there are stories in the book of folks who've done it all by themselves. So,
well, any time a person, especially somebody who has been abusing alcohol heavily, hard and heavy for a long time, there is a risk, you know, with a very heavy drinker that they might have problems with withdrawal symptoms. And so, you know, to play it safe, ideally, there are people, a lot of people in the book who just quit cold turkey. But that's risky because you can run into medical complications when you suddenly stop drinking alcohol if you've been abusing it. The people who are usually most successful at stopping drinking on their own are usually people with less severe alcohol problems. That's not always the case, but they're usually people, you know, one of the things that we have to remember with alcohol problems is that it's not just one problem. It's a huge spectrum of problems, just like with high blood pressure. We have mild high blood pressure, and we have severe high blood pressure, and we have all kinds of things in between. And most people with alcohol problems are not severe alcoholics, the stereotypical drunk that we have in our mind or that we see on TV. Most people with alcohol problems are at the other end of the spectrum. They're people with mild to moderate alcohol problems for whom there are very few resources, and that's why I wanted to reach out to them. But anyway, usually people at the lower end of that severity spectrum are the ones who are more successful on their own. A perfect example of this is our new president, George W. Bush. As far as we know, according to public accounts, he once had a problem with alcohol, recognized it was causing problems in his life, quit quietly on his own, without going to treatment, without going to AA. I don't believe he ever called himself an alcoholic, but he quit drinking and is not drinking today.
The masters that you surveyed for Sober for Good, how diverse a group?
Oh, you know, I have people from all walks of life. I mean, I have doctors and lawyers, college professors, but I also have people who are former topless dancers, everything you can imagine, teachers, homemakers. I have people, wonderful stories of people who, there was one gentleman I can think of in the book who, what did he tell me, over the course of something like 10 years, he held down something like 53 jobs. He just bounced from one job to the next. He was basically living on the streets, panhandling, and he's now a successful attorney. So there are these remarkable turnaround stories, but there are also stories of people who recognized that their alcohol was a problem before it got bad. As I mentioned earlier, one of the stories that I really connected with as a mother was a story of Liz, who I tell her story in the chapter about how do you start to recognize that you're having alcohol problems. And she never called herself an alcoholic. She never hit bottom. She felt that, although one of the things that was interesting about her is that she never drank more than 4 or 5 glasses of wine a day. Now, granted, that's much more than most of us think of as healthy drinking, but it's not what most of us think of as alcoholic drinking. And that amount of alcohol was over the course of many hours. From about 3 in the afternoon, she'd start drinking with her lady friends while they were watching the kids play. And she might drink that much, the four to five glasses of wine between 3 in the afternoon and 7 or 8 at night. So it was spread over a long period of time. She recognized that alcohol was causing problems. She started to see that it was a common thread amongst her problems, the arguments with her husband, the being petulant and, you know, short with people. She said she was a mean drunk. But the thing that really I connected with as a mother was one time her third grade son was interviewing his mom on his tape recorder for a school project. And he played it back for her, and it was in the evening, and her speech was slurred. And that was one of the things that really began to turn her around, because it reminded her of her father, who also had a serious drinking problem, and how he sounded, and she reminded him of her, what she described as his boozy breath, you know, when he tucked her in at night. And she didn't want to be that kind of role model for her two little boys.
Hmm. Prior to getting to know these folks, did you know the experiences of people with drinking problems were so diverse?
Oh, yes. You know, what I did before I actually wrote the book was I went to the scientific literature. I brought every textbook that you can find and did a scientific literature search of research studies called treatment outcome studies to see what the research suggested that were the things that were most important for resolving alcohol problems. And I did find that many of the people in the book told me things that were consistent with the scientific research. And so, you know, I kind of knew, I suspected that some of those things might become evident as I was talking to people. And I really knew from personal experience, too, that there was this huge spectrum of drinking problems and people from all walks of life who struggled with this.
Hmm. There's a wide range of drinking problems out there, and there's no one path to sobriety that's right for everyone. But are there common threads in the stories of the people you surveyed?
Yes, definitely. One of the things that really struck me was when I was reading through the questionnaires, I started, you know, I was looking for patterns. I was looking for, we actually entered all the response, I had a researcher help me enter some of the responses into a database so we could just see how often people said what to which questions. And one of the things I saw over and over again was a profound commitment to abstinence. People, none of this one-day-at-a-time philosophy, which may be helpful to many people in the beginning of sobriety, but most of these people told me that now that they're well into sobriety, and many of them early on in sobriety told me they didn't use one day at a time, they had to make a commitment that they were going to change their relationship with alcohol forever. And many people told me that for most of the people in the book, that meant never having another drink. And that cut across recovery methods, not just, you know, I heard it from AAs, I heard it from people who went to some of the non-traditional recovery groups. You know, I heard it from people who recovered in many different ways. I also, one of the things that people do to stay motivated, which also cut across recovery methods, was they never allow themselves to forget the past. They keep a memory in their mind of what it was like the last time they took a drink, and they don't want to go back there. There's a saying at AA that is very helpful, at least I heard it at AA, and it goes, think the drink all the way through. Past the first early moments of gratification with those first couple of drinks to where it usually takes you. But in the next breath, people would tell me how they celebrate sobriety and how much joy they have and how they just wouldn't want to give that up now that they're sober.
Yeah. It's also interesting to think on this one day at a time thing, how some folks that leads them to think about, well, you know, down the line, there could be a day that comes that, you know, if planets are in a certain arrangement,
right, in
alignment, well, then I'll have a drink to celebrate.
Yeah. You know, I think, as I said, you know, it's possible that more people use that philosophy early on than shared it with me because, you know, they're kind of, you had to be at least 5 years into sobriety to be in the book. And I think, you know, in the beginning, when you're really struggling, because it is, I don't want to downplay how hard it is to give up something that you love, that's become very important to you. Whether or not you're physiologically addicted to it, it becomes an important part of a problem drinker's life, and it's very painful to give it up. And so I think that sometimes it is very helpful to people in the beginning of sobriety to say, you know, I just have to think about today. And if I can make it through today, then I can make it through another day. So I don't want to suggest that that's not helpful to some people. I think one of the most important messages of the book, through the stories of these people who've done it in so many ways, is that you have to find what's right for you. It's the important thing is that one size doesn't fit all.
Mm. And sobriety is not static. That's another point you...
Right. What works for people at some points in sobriety changes. One of the things that was very interesting to me is that I had several people in the book who quit drinking completely on their own, remained sober for a number of years completely on their own, and they now go to AA. And I have just the opposite. I have a number of people who went to AA, they became sober with AA, but they no longer feel a need to go to recovery groups. And I think that's encouraging for people who kind of have this image that you have to keep going to AA for the rest of your life. And in fact, a lot of people, that's one of the myths that shattered, is that you don't have to be in recovery forever. Many people see themselves as recovered, past tense, and they've moved on with their lives. But they might go back to a recovery group if they're having a tough time emotionally and they feel that they need support. So, yes, you're right. Sobriety is not static.
Yeah, I think one woman told you she might not go to an AA meeting for a year or more, but if things get tough in her life, she's there a couple times a week.
Yep, exactly.
Ann Fletcher is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with her about her book, Sober for Good, New Solutions for Drinking Problems, Advice for Those Who Have Succeeded. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line 2 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you, Ann. I belong to the Rational Recovery Group, RR, Jack Trimpe.
Sure.
I'm sure you're familiar with us. our main criticism with AA is that alcoholism is a philosophy. It's not a disease. You know, Hinduism, Buddhism, atheism, faith and belief in man, alcoholism, faith and belief in alcohol, and that Alcoholics Anonymous does much more damage than good. It has been declared through us a religious organization in the Supreme Court of New York State, and people cannot be forced, after getting a DUI on the highway, to belong to an organization that they don't approve of. I just wondered what you thought of that.
I do talk about that in the book, that, you know, and I do tell some stories of 12-step coercion, people who are forced to go to AA, and I do think that those are landmark cases that you're talking about. Four, I believe it's appeals courts, have ruled that people can no longer be mandated to attend AA. They have to be also offered some secular alternatives, and I support that. I think it's very wise. And they've ruled that because they see that forcing people to attend AA, they've ruled that AA is religious, although AA describes itself as a spiritual program. But those four courts have ruled that. It's not the case in all states, but I do think that that is important. Again, I think it's so important that people be offered options. I take the position that AA has helped many, many people. I heard from hundreds of them. But I also heard from many, many people whose lives were damaged because they were told that AA is the only way, and they were not able to get sober until they found an alternative to AA. And I think one of the things I want to get across is that there are these alternative approaches. This gentleman mentioned that he's affiliated with Rational Recovery, which is largely an approach on the Internet, which is mentioned, and the website is given in my book, as is information about some alternative support groups that offer most of them weekly programs, Smart Recovery, Secular Organizations for Sobriety, which calls itself SOS, and Women for Sobriety, and information about how to locate these groups. which are available nationwide, is in the book. And also, if you don't have access to one of these alternatives in your area, all of these groups have websites, and many of them have online resources and meetings that people can access. So I'm glad, really glad to hear from you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. In the area of, you know, when somebody finds themselves in trouble with their drinking problem because of an arrest for driving under the influence, how might we think about this more smartly in society dealing with the problem of drunken driving?
Well, that's an interesting question. In doing the research for the book, I was surprised to find that most people who are drunk driving offenders are not alcohol dependent. That is what most of us think of as alcoholics. They're alcohol abusers. And, you know, I think what, I mean, this is just my opinion. I think what often happens is when you, I can give you again an example of somebody that I talked to in writing the book who is not an alcohol, he's not an alcoholic. He was never alcohol dependent. He made poor choices when he was young, was involved with a rowdy drinking crowd. He had 3 drunk driving arrests. And he was forced to go to AA more than once. He was forced to go to 12-step-based treatment programs and AA. And unfortunately, I think what happens with somebody who he really didn't need to be abstinent because he's a grown-up now, he's an adult, and many people mature out of their drinking problems, as this gentleman did. And, I mean, he told me, I know this guy, he's somebody I know in my own personal life, and he could take or leave a beer. You know, he said it's a beverage to him now. And he said, I just needed to grow up and find new friends. And I think that, you know, nobody teaches us how to drink in our society. And as Alan Marlatt, who is the director of the Addictive Research Behavior Center at the University of Washington, who was a consultant for my book, he said the following to me when I was writing the book. We don't take a child and give them the keys to a car at 16 and say, go drive. We give them lessons. But think about it. We give people a license to drink at 21, but we never really give them any lessons. Along the way, now this is coming from me, but along the way, kids are told abstinence, abstinence, and then all of a sudden they can drink. And, you know, well, gee, no wonder we have such a problem with binge drinking on college campuses. You know, one of the approaches that can be offered to alcohol abusers is a moderation approach, and where people are taught to drink in a more responsible fashion, taught to handle this same gentleman I talked about who abused alcohol when he was younger. One of the things that he did learn in treatment that was very valuable was to learn to label his emotions rather than smother them with alcohol. He learned to say, oh, yeah, I really am unhappy today. And once he could, and that's so important, is to learn to recognize what your emotions are and then to learn to deal with them appropriately, because alcohol is not going to solve the problem in the long run. But people can be taught these skills outside of an abstinence-based group. And I would suggest that if somebody is a problem drinker and they would like to try a moderate drinking approach, that they do it with some professional help. They should do it with somebody like a cognitive behavioral therapist who has some expertise in this area, or with a program such as DrinkWise or Moderation Management. And those resources are also mentioned in the book, and you can locate them online. And then, if that doesn't work for a person and they still are really having a lot of problems with alcohol, then maybe they should be stepped up to an abstinence-based approach. It all goes along with the more options we can offer, the more likely we are to help people. It's said, the research suggests that only 1 in 10 people with a serious drinking problem ever seeks help. And, you know, part of that may be because people don't want help, but I also heard from the stories of people in the book that a lot of it is because they just didn't feel they had any options, but they found them.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, this one in Chicago on line 4. Hello.
Thank you. I'd like to make a comment on a statement you made about President Bush about quitting cold turkey. Well, that was preceded by his having a full-day encounter with Reverend Billy Graham.
I heard that,
yes.
Yes.
And that day forward, I think he no longer drank. But going back to the matter of excess of drinking here and there, young people being told, well, you get to a certain age, you can start drinking. Well, on certain campuses, universities, I think there are certain excesses, with beer kegs and parties and the different games that are going on, you know, tail wagon, whatever goes on, and leading on to advertising that we see now suddenly engulfing TV ads and an encroachment of alcohol drinking. And just all those points that would persuade people to get into it, try it, and so forth. You know, it's like the story with Virginia Slims and how women were induced to thinking, well, hey, you got to have your share of tobacco, too, way back. So advertising has a great part in enhancing the desirability of drinking. But another point I wanted to make, and it relates to something that was talked about yesterday in relation to tobacco, it replies also to drinking, that these are the highest, among the highest tax-producing products that the government relies on for tax revenue. And therefore, to say that they're going to come down on it, even though the death rate on the highways and the accidents from drinking is so huge that they even dwarf the damage that occurs in wars. So they need more attention to it.
Those are excellent points, and all the more reason we need more options for dealing with this. And those are very interesting points that you raise.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, your questions for Ann Fletcher are welcome this afternoon. We're talking with her about her book, Sober for Good, New Solutions for Drinking Problems, Advice from Those Who Have Succeeded. The telephone number is 333-WILL. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. The Masters, the folks that you interviewed for the book, do some or any of them think of alcoholism as a disease?
Yes, a good number of them do, but yeah, I'm kind of on the fence about it, and I didn't think it was important for me to take a position on either side. And as one gentleman said, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's a disease. It's still, what am I going to do about it? There definitely is research that shows that there probably is a biological inherited component to this. But as one expert said, and I think it's very important, is that, you know, genes are not destiny. Certainly somebody who has a long history of alcohol problems in their family needs to be more, you know, it would be wise for them to be more vigilant. Because alcohol problems do tend to run in families. But on the other hand, some of it is learned behavior. I talked to a young woman the other day who abused alcohol very heavily for many years, and she said that she felt that for her, she didn't feel it was a disease. She thought she observed her father. That was how he coped with all of his problems in life, and that was the way she learned to cope with problems as well. So, you know, it's probably a combination of things and different variations in different people. You know, I think someday we're going to find out that, you know, that it's a whole different combination of factors that lead to alcohol problems.
Mm. What if someone has tried and failed and tried and failed and tried and failed?
Well, you know, we read stories of certain celebrities where this is the case, and they really break my heart. But what usually happens is that, you know, they keep getting sent back to the same kinds of approaches, the same kinds of treatment programs. 93% of treatment programs in the United States are based on the 12 steps of AA. I mean, that comes from research, a big treatment study that was done at the University of Georgia. And, you know, with high blood pressure, using the analogy that I mentioned earlier, that, you know, if a medication doesn't work for high blood pressure, we switch the person to something else. So my best advice would be, if one thing doesn't work, try another.
Yeah. And there's so many stories in the book about folks that are just, you know, really inspirational. They just tried it again and again. And
right, right.
No
Most
matter
of these
what.
People relapsed before they, you know, finally really did something about. The other thing, too, that goes along with that is that, you know, one of the myths is that if you're not ready to quit drinking, there's nothing you can do in the meantime, even though quitting completely might be ideal for you. A number of people told me about how, even though they weren't quite ready to give it up, they knew they had a problem, and they went to see a therapist who helped them lower the harm that alcohol was causing in their lives. You know, one woman said, I went to a psychiatrist, and she told me, you know, I could never drink on an empty stomach. I could never drink after 5 in the afternoon. And another person told me that she went to a therapist who got her exercising, even though she was mm-hmm. still drinking heavily. And she found that on the nights that she exercised, she was much less inclined to drink. So it was interesting that she was doing some things that moved her in the right direction before she made the decision to give it up completely.
Yeah, says a lot about denial, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's talk with some other listeners. Next, we go to a caller on campus on line 1. Hi.
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 I'm really enjoying your program, and I want to get your book.
Oh, thank you.
My question is really, I know someone who's in the early stages of struggling with this kind of thing, and I want to know, what do I do to best support someone?
Great question.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, because that is a question that I asked everybody in the book. Now that they're on the other side of a drinking problem themselves, what advice do they have to friends and family members who are still struggling with a drinking problem? The bad news is that I don't have any magic to offer, and nor did the people in the book. But what I do in the book is offer a whole chapter that offers lots of their ideas and suggestions. I can tell you one of the things that I heard over and over again does not work, and that's nagging, preaching, and complaining. I tell the what I do is profile a person in the beginning of each chapter and tell their whole story. And the woman I profile in that chapter told me how for 2 decades, her husband nagged, preached, and complained, and actually made their little boy, the liquor cop, as she called him, that he was supposed to watch mommy during the day when dad wasn't around and dump the alcohol down the drain. And it doesn't sound like your friend is that severe, but I'm just going to tell you this one story because it's interesting. And she said all of that nagging, preaching, and complaining and policing absolutely did not work and sometimes made her worse and want to drink all the more. What did work for her and what turned her around was one night she came out of one of her drunken stupors and she found a note tucked inside her blouse from her 9-year-old son that said, "Dear Mommy, I love you so much. Please stop doing this to yourself because I'm afraid you're going to kill yourself." That was the turning point for her. She said that was the first time anybody had ever addressed my problem, my drinking problem, in a loving way. Mm-hmm. So I think I heard that over and over again. Don't nag, preach, complain, but do not ignore the problem either. Confront it in a non-adversarial way, but you know, and never stop loving the person. Continue to love them and support them. I also went to some very interesting research studies that are going on right now with some fascinating family interventions that are being used, and I don't mean intervention in the classic, like AA intervention sort of way. They're family approaches to alcohol recovery that are really counter to what many people have been led to believe, which is you can't do much to help a problem drinker. You can only help yourself. That's a myth. In fact, one of the things that can help people is to talk about how the alcohol problem affects you. Instead of saying, "You did this," and "Did you know you did that last night?" to say things like, "You know, I really feel bad when you're drinking because you can't remember anything I tell you, you know, the night before. It makes me feel so bad the next day because I thought what I was telling you last night was important and now you don't remember anything like that." I remember one time when my sister did that to me, and it had a big impact when she said to me, "You know, I feel bad because you don't remember the conversation we had last night, and you seem very passionate about the subject." That really, it didn't make me stop drinking, but it really made me stop and think. Another thing, too, is to provide support for sober behavior. Like, you know, one of the things like a spouse, a wife might say to a husband is, "Gee, I had a really good time with you last night. You know, you didn't drink much last night, and your behavior was so different in the following ways. You know, we had a good time, we talked, we went for a walk." So those are some of the ideas. I don't know if that gives you any insights, but there are lots of things like that in that chapter that are just kind of tips that you can do to work with somebody with a drinking problem.
Well, great. Thank you very much.
And help that person shop around and explore the options.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Uh-huh.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to a listener on the toll-free line on a cell phone. Good afternoon. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, I'm a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober for 7.5 years. I'd just like to make a couple of quick points, and then you could comment on them if you'd like. One is, if a person is truly an alcoholic, the only sure one is total abstinence. And the second point being that AA, which I'm a member of, has been in existence for 60-plus years. And I'm just wondering how long these other programs have been in existence. Thank you.
Okay. Good question.
First of all, congratulations on the 7.5 years of sobriety. That's no small feat, and that's wonderful. And I do want to make it clear again that this book supports AA. It's just, you know, there's no question that countless people have been saved by AA, and I heard many of those people. 97 of the people in the book recovered with AA. The other 125 recovered in other ways. I don't know the length of time that Women for Sobriety has been around. I believe it's at least 10 years. But, you know, just because something's been around for a long time doesn't mean that it's the most effective approach. And there really is no research evidence that AA is any more effective than other approaches. I mean, one of the things that's been around for a long time is that people who've been able to quit drinking on their own, you know, so I think it's, you know, again, the whole idea here is to open up and offer options. And, you know, if, you know, many people who go to AA never go back. Or there are some figures that suggest that people who, at the end of a year, only 1 in 10 people who goes to AA sticks with it. And it may be that that person is not ready at that point in time. It may be that they're in some degree of denial, but it also may mean that that approach is not right for them. You know, one of the things that's very interesting is that I had a number of people in the book who used a combination of approaches. I have a couple who quit drinking together, and they go to both secular organizations for sobriety, SOS, and AA, so that, you know, they kind of take the best of more than one program. So, you know, I think that all of these things are viable options. And, you know, again, if one thing doesn't work, just try another.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. This one on line 2 in Champaign. Good afternoon. Hi there.
Is this line 2?
That's you.
Okay, thanks. I guess I tried to barge in before. I'm sorry. I worked in the substance abuse field about 30 years, mostly with alcoholics. I'm wondering, are the author... are you in recovery, or were you close to the problem?
Yes, you may not have heard that at the beginning of the interview.
I'm a person who has
been sober for many years and have been to many AA meetings and have visited various recovery groups, and I'm very familiar with this from firsthand experience.
Yeah, okay. What was your main avenue of recovery?
I largely resolved my drinking problem with one-on-one counseling with a psychologist who had expertise in the area. But I also went to AA. I didn't use the 12-step philosophy, but I found the group support to be very helpful to me early on in my recovery.
I worked my last 20-some years in the Veterans Administration.
Uh-huh.
Were you able to interview any veterans in that?
I do. I have
sample?
A number of people, yes. In fact, I have a gentleman who... he went to a VA, the one that jumps into my mind, went to a VA treatment program, and he's one of the ones who uses a combination of approaches. He goes to it was largely a 12-step-based VA program that he went through, but he also, and he goes to a 12-step aftercare meeting, but he also goes to an SOS meeting, which he finds to be very helpful, and I think he also had some individual therapy. People told me that they had individual counseling in addition to going to whatever recovery group they went to.
Two other questions. What do you think of the role of religion in recovery?
There's an entire chapter in Sober for Good on the role of spirituality in recovery. And now remember, this book is not about me, although I do briefly tell my story in the beginning of the book, and it's not about my opinion. It's about what I found. And what I do is share the stories of how different people use spirituality and religion in recovery. And I do have some people who are very religious, but they didn't like the AA powerlessness philosophy or turning it over to a higher power, but they're still devout Christians.
Well,
I have some people who had a Christian awakening that had nothing to do with AA, and that was the turning point in their recovery.
Were these people involved with a church, or were they just mouthing it?
No, I think that these were people who were like born-again Christians. The person who I profile in that chapter happens to go to a group called Smart Recovery. He's a devout Christian who reads the Bible every day and prays and meditates on a daily basis, but he didn't. The AA philosophy didn't appeal to him. Smart Recovery appealed to him more because he felt it was a more empowering approach.
We had some problems with patients in treatment, and I was mostly in rehab, and mostly with adults. We had some problems with patients. It's always the situation of denial and thinking they can go back to controlled drinking, and you see a lot of relapses. But what do you think about these efforts to help people get into controlled drinking?
Well, I think that there's a big difference between somebody going back, thinking that they can go back to drinking after they've been happily abstinent for a long time.
Yeah.
Why tempt fate? I don't recommend that at all, nor do any of these programs.
Well, I think a lot of times it's unpremeditated. It just happens.
Yes, you know, and one of the things I talk about in the book is how not to let a lapse become a relapse. You know, I have one gentleman who, after many years of sobriety, had one night where he as they say in AA, went out and drank one night. He kind of went back to some bad environments, bars and whatnot, and he drank that one night. But that was it. He cut it off. He examined why it happened. And the next day he said, there's no reason I can't start over today. And he's been sober for another, whatever it is, 6 years beyond that. So I think it's very, very important for people to let to know that a slip doesn't have to mean a fall. A lapse doesn't have to become a relapse. I think that for somebody who there actually is some research evidence that a small number of people are able to have an occasional drink after having had a serious drinking problem. 9 out of 10 people in the book, however, have made a profound commitment to abstinence. And there's a whole chapter on how they made that commitment to abstinence. There's a small number of people in the book and in research studies that are able to do this. They're usually people with less severe drinking problems at the outset. And as I said earlier, I encourage anybody who wants to try one of these approaches to do it with some guidance. Go to a support program like DrinkWise Moderation Management or with a therapist who knows how to work with a person and also knows how to get that person help. If that doesn't work out, and to help them get abstinence-based support after that.
Mm. I want to thank the caller for his call this afternoon, and we're coming down here on the time that we can spend with Ann Fletcher today, so I want to get in our last caller of the day, a listener in DeKalb. Good afternoon.
Yes, I was recently... by the way, I wanted to thank you for an informative show that is really uses empirical research and evidence, and you're not just on a soapbox trying to preach
Thank
something,
you.
Which I
Thank
get tired
you.
Of.
Nice to hear.
NPR is guilty of that as much as everybody else, and it's a pleasure to hear this kind of fairness. What I wanted to say is that I don't know if you touched on this because that would be away from the radio, but in Madison they're having a lot of trouble with binge drinking, and I heard the president of the college up there saying that probably the worst thing this country ever did was have this whole concept of a drinking age. When you look at Europe and the kind of lower rates of, it's almost unheard of to have drunk driving, lower rates of alcohol problems of all kind, I don't think we could just make that switch, but I often think that's probably the worst thing we ever did in this country was to have this whole concept of a drinking age where you can turn a magic age and go out and binge.
Now, it's a very interesting comment, and my sentiments are similar, are along the same lines, but I don't, to be honest with you, I don't address, it's not a book about prevention, it's a book about people who've overcome drinking problems, and I'm not an expert in that area. And I've seen, you know, I collect articles on this. This may be the subject for another book, because I'm very interested in prevention, especially having two teenage sons of my own. And I do wonder about this. I've seen some conflicting stuff, because, you know, one of the problems is that people who abuse alcohol at a young age, you know, problems tend to excel. People who start drinking at an early age who are going to develop an alcohol problem seem to develop worse problems and develop it sooner. I remember seeing something on that of late. I saw something recently, too, about some problems with binge drinking in some societies where I thought they weren't a problem, you know, other cultures where the drinking age was less of an issue. So I don't think there's a simple answer to that, but I know my gut reaction is, as I said earlier, you know, we never teach anybody how to drink responsibly. And you know, again, I mentioned Dr. Alan Marlatt earlier. He is doing some research along these lines and helping kids learn responsible drinking and what's called harm reduction principles, knowing that most kids are not going to be abstinent, especially on college campuses. And they've actually had some very promising findings about helping kids drink less and have less problems with alcohol. And so I think we're going to be seeing more programs like this in the future.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. What kind of reaction is the book getting from people working in the field of addiction recovery?
Well, to be honest with you, the book just came out, so it's hard for me to say yet. I have been on a few TV shows in my home market, which was the Minneapolis market, and was very pleased that when I was on a TV show with a recovering chef, he happened to be a chef that was a regular on the TV show, and he was very involved in 12-step programs, and he seemed to feel he was very supportive of the book. And I think anybody who truly wants to help people with drinking problems feels the more options we can offer, the better chance we have of reaching the 9 out of 10 people with drinking problems who are not finding a solution.
Ann, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Ann Fletcher is the author of Sober for Good, New Solutions for Drinking Problems, Advice from Those Who Have Succeeded. You can check out the book. It's now in bookstores. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Also, today in the New York Times, the book was profiled by Jane Brody, the health writer, and it was also profiled by USA Today. So if you'd like to seek out those newspapers for some more information on the book, that you could do that. Sober for Good, Anne M. Fletcher, the publisher, Houghton Mifflin.